Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
My name is Huy. I'm a journalist and writer in Berlin, and I'm really happy to be on the podcast and speak to you. I'm the author of a novel that just came out in the US. It's called Brothers and Ghosts, and it's loosely inspired by my own Vietnamese family.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Quay. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. Yeah, it's really great to be here.
Thank you. How did your family get to Germany?
My parents came from South Vietnam to Western Germany. At that time, in 1969 and 1970, Vietnam was divided, as we know. And then Germany was divided too. So they came to Western Germany as students, and they had initially planned to, you know, get a university education, get some good qualifications, go back to the motherland and, you know, like work there. But by the time they finished their study, of course, Vietnam was not the same country as before. So they stayed, got jobs and had children, and they are still here.
And so you were born sometime in the 80s, and your parents were they nationalized at the time? Did they get their citizenships?
Well, yeah, and they got German citizenship. I didn't know which year they got it, but they got it before I was born. I was born in 1982. So at that time, again, Germany was divided. I grew up in West Germany with German citizenship. I had this German passport. I grew up speaking Vietnamese at home, but I kind of lost a lot of the language when I entered nursery and then later school. So German was really like almost like my mother tongue. But at that time, it was very, it was very unusual for Germans to see an Asian-looking person walking on the street. Yeah. The Asian community is just so much smaller than the US. So I very much grew up with this feeling of being somehow, you know, like very exotic and being somebody who seemed to be puzzling to a lot of people, who a lot of people thought, you know, like was not from here, even though, you know, Germany was all I knew pretty much.
That's an incredible sort of position that we all, kids that are born outside of Vietnam and in these different countries, you know, weird. It's just such a weird experience being born outside of Vietnam. And then when you grow up a little bit, you're like, wait, that's a really strange thing to be born outside of our country of origin, right?
Yeah, but you know, like even when I was a kid, we'd sometimes go visit our relatives in California, and they live in Little Saigon. And there were all these Vietnamese people kind of on the street, and they always had Vietnamese friends over, and there would always be this restaurant really specialized only for pho, only for soy. And, you know, like looking at that, I always thought, oh, it must be so much easier to live here. Why am I living in Germany where I'm the only one? Whereas here in the US, it seemed so much easier. I don't know what it was like for you, but kind of looking at it from afar, I just felt a certain, felt a certain sense of envy or longing at what you had.
Yeah.
Or what I thought.
I think it's a blessing and a cursing, a blessing and a curse at the same time, because the blessing is
I grew up about an hour away, 45 minutes from Orange County, where all the Vietnamese people. So I grew up around a lot of Black Americans and Mexican Americans in my neighborhood, and then it became Korean Americans, Koreatown. And so growing up away, like an hour away, is not like you, where you grew up, countries away from the homeland, or not a lot of Vietnamese or Asian people. I think there is a different perspective for you who didn't grow up around a lot of Asians. And for me, just an hour away, there was a whole community. And then as I got older, I began to spend a lot more time in that community. So I think there's different variations of the blessings and the curse. The blessing is when you're growing up around a big population of Vietnamese, you kind of have an anchor of like who you are. And if you grew up an hour away, you're still away from the main thing. The blessing is having that perspective of being away from your mother culture gives you a little bit more a runway for an expansive sort of look into other things and topics about the world. Like for you, you're able to explore things that are way beyond the Vietnamese community. Like, we'll get into this, but your Kevin Spacey article allows you to kind of, and when you grew up in a community where it's like predominantly Asian or predominantly Vietnamese, you don't often, I mean, it happens, definitely. There's a lot of journalists and people that leave the community in Orange County. But for you, it's like the blessing is definitely being able to live a life that's more expansive beyond the culture.
Yeah, I guess I very much had the feeling that Vietnamese culture was something that was related to the family. It was something that was home. Sometimes we would meet my parents' friends for dinners or barbecues, and we'd hang out with, I'd hang out with the other children or whatever. But the official life, the normal life, the German life was kind of outside of the house. And I guess later on, when I went into writing and traveling, it was much more kind of like that more mainstream world I was engaging with, the more outside world, I guess. I always felt that the two were quite separate, the two identities, the two worlds within me.
What got you into writing?
I do think that this tension has a lot to do with it. I'm not the type of person who would normally go around speaking very much about my identity or these questions which we're discussing right here on this show. I certainly never really did that when I was younger because I felt that people were laying their cliches and expectations so much into me that I just almost wanted to just get away from it and not really dive too deeply into my own personal history. And also because a lot of the time I just felt they wouldn't understand, what I told you about Germany before. There just wasn't, especially in the 80s and the 90s, there just wasn't much of any kind of cultural sensibility or sense of welcoming diversity, whatever.
Has it
So I
changed
had all these,
much?
yeah, I would say has changed. Especially Berlin has changed. It's become so much more international now. It's, like my son, he goes to a nursery. He's like mixed, if you want. And he's not like an outsider. He's not the only one. We also have, unfortunately, we have the rise of the far right at the same time. We have both. Things have gotten better and things have also gotten worse. But for me, I just now feel much more, I guess, at ease in Germany now. And I feel that in my writing, I can explore and maybe also describe a lot of the tensions that I've kept to myself for a long time. And now I actually feel that, the things that I perhaps felt burdened with when I was younger, like maybe the doubts and the questions, perhaps even a sense of shame that probably a lot of people know. These are great things to power your writing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Writing, if you didn't have any tension within you, if you didn't have any drama, And if you just go through life feeling quite happy about yourself, then there would be nothing to write about.
Yep. It's the blessing, right? It's the blessing that comes with...
And also, I even like as a journalist, when I interview people, I just find people who have some sort of brokenness in them, some sort of contradiction. Something where you feel underneath the surface there's an abyss there. I find them so much more interesting because there's always something to explore. And I have a lot of sympathy for that.
Yeah, and I think that abyss that you're talking about, that depth that you're talking about, provides some sort of universal coverage for the rest of us who are consuming this content. Like when I think about how you approach the Kevin Spacey article, I could relate to Kevin Spacey on some level, you know?
Because, really?
Yeah, because I feel like I've been an outcast many times in my life. And trying to get back into the in-group, you know, because of the things that I've done, or I felt that way before, you know. So that abyss and the brokenness, I think that's a universal feeling that we all feel at one point or another in our life.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think you are actually the first person to draw that parallel between Kevin Spacey and the question of cultural identity, and you're totally spot on. I should maybe I should explain a bit so people know what we're talking about. A while ago, as a writer, I unexpectedly got to write a profile of Kevin Spacey, which was the first time he had ever spoken to a journalist since the accusations of sexual assault came up in 2017. And I initially had wanted, I just kind of picked up that he was working on a low budget film in the UK.
Let's give everybody this context of who Kevin Spacey is. He's a huge American actor. He's won two awards, Oscars, one for American Beauty, and I forget what the other one was for. It's for an older film.
It's The Usual Suspects.
The Usual Suspects, I think a Tarantino film, but two big awards, and you know, I think the Netflix one,
House of Cards. He was the first big star of Netflix. House of Cards was huge, and it really made Netflix. It was the first kind of original Netflix show.
Right. I think House of Cards started when Netflix was still sending out DVDs to addresses. So Kevin Spacey was one of the original, like, big time actor anchors that helped Netflix propel itself up. So he's a big, for all the people who don't know who Kevin Spacey is, he's a huge name, and he was accused of sexually assaulting somebody who was 14 years old, like 30 years ago. And now he's banished from the Hollywood kingdom, and, you know, and he has never given an interview to anybody in the U.S., since that has happened. And so now we're here with an article that you wrote about. Sorry, I should have given this context much earlier, but we got into the conversation so midway. So sorry. So if you could pick up where you were leaving off.
Yeah, so it was initially kind of like the allegation brought him down was by a former actor. That was kind of like referring back to an incident 30 years ago. And after that, a huge number of men in the UK where he had kind of worked as at a theater, and also in the US had come forward alleging that he had, you know, like sexually approached them and assaulted them. And he really was one of the big cases of the Me Too era, and he was banished. Like he had been on the top of the world, two times Oscar winner, and suddenly he was kind of like persona non grata in Hollywood or the liberal establishment. And so he was gone for a long time. And then I heard that he was working on a low budget film, providing only a voice role. And I thought, this is interesting. You know, like I thought Kevin Spacey is still kind of, he was still accused of sexual assault. He was actually awaiting a big trial in London, and he's working on a film again. How can that be? And through the director of the film, I actually got in touch with Spacey's manager, and I got to meet him in person. And I really met a man who was walking between two worlds. On the one hand,
before you get into that, can you tell me about you hear about the movie being made and you reach out to the manager of the director, and then how does that even go? Like, you did that, you reached out, or did the company you work for, did they send people to reach out between managers and agents, and or was it very unofficial?
No, it was me. Like, so I work for a magazine, a German magazine. It's called Zeit Magazine, and we do a lot of kind of like in-depth long-form stories. I don't know, like in the Atlantic or New York or whatever. So you are, as a writer, you're like the author, and then you try to, when you come up with an idea, you pitch it to your team, and then you start working it. You start reaching out to people to ask if you can interview them. At that point in time, when I first had contact with Spacey's manager, I didn't even ask him for an interview because I just didn't think that would be an option or that it could even be interesting to us. I just wanted to ask him for a few quotes for my piece about that film.
Well,
so it started with a very small idea, I guess. And then I heard that he was about to be awarded an event in Italy. So I flew to Italy and I met him in person. That's when I met Kevin Spacey in person. I saw that even though the news reporting had all been about, you know, like, this is the disgraced Hollywood star who's been accused by dozens of men. And at the same time, I just thought that he still had so many fans in Italy. And later on, I would actually see that he still has a lot of fans in the US too, because, you know, like, as you said before, he has a long track record as, you know, working in Hollywood. And I think even those who may find him despicable as a character will still acknowledge he was probably one of the greatest actors of his generation. And there's this contradiction that we spoke about earlier. And I was so fascinated. I don't know. I was just so fascinated by the story of somebody who was, what I just wondered, you know, what is it like if you had once been like on top of the world and suddenly you're kind of like at the bottom or nowhere? What does that feel like? There are not that many people you can ask this, right? Mm-hmm. Then I'm not on that level. What does it feel like to be banished? And I met him and I just noticed that he was very kind of like wounded. And it was, there's a lot of tension within him. And he was, you know, like, he was clearly kind of like, on the one hand, he was really enjoying his moment in spotlight in Italy when he was given the award. And he could really go into that role of being that Hollywood star and shaking everyone's hand and making jokes. But at the same time, of course, there's a dark cloud hanging over him, the upcoming trial.
Can I ask you about that? Because when I read about that in the article that you wrote, I kind of thought about how Europeans look at what Kevin Spacey did as opposed to how Americans view. Because I think Americans are... just, we approach sex very differently than Europe, right? Now, do you feel like in Italy, they sort of not thought that whatever he did was a big deal? Or do, it just seems like they didn't really care. I mean, you're going to have an award show and you're going to award Kevin Spacey, who's been
I mean, that would never happen in the US. Never, ever would that happen in the US. And it also wouldn't happen in Germany. But in Italy, I think it is quite different. Maybe even France a bit, but Italy certainly, people were saying very openly, you know, oh, we had these great geniuses, Leonardo da Vinci, Caravaggio. Yes, they were kind of like accused of molesting people, but they're still great artists. You have to separate the art from the person. That was their argument in Italy. And indeed, some people, I do feel that, you know, like there's still a lot of people who listen to the music of Michael Jackson. There's an interesting debate to have here, right? On an emotional level. There's an intellectual debate and then there's an emotional level. And I just felt, you know, as a journalist looking at that, I just noticed, okay, all right. On the one hand, you know, like in public discourse, this guy is not satisfiable anymore. But here on the kind of on the ground, clearly people feel very differently. And and I was kind of, I don't know, I spent some time with him. I would later go and visit him in Baltimore where he lives, spend a day with him. And he, I guess he really introduced me a bit. He showed me a bit of his life. But I was also kind of like, it was very difficult for me. On the one hand, I wanted to really understand the story on a human level. On the other hand, of course, I had done the research about, you know, the allegations and the legal questions. And I was not, I also wanted to keep the journalistic distance. And I was also, I also wanted to publish this piece before his upcoming trial. And I just thought, I cannot write something that either condemns him or sets him free. You right. know, like I have to somehow maintain a neutral line with my piece. And there was one thing that I should perhaps mention just because it was before the trial. There's a law in Britain according to which you're not allowed in the media to speak about kind of allegations that will go to trial. So we could not, when in my whole interactions against Kevin Spacey, I could not ask him, did you do it or did you not do it? Or what's your version of the story? I could only try to ask him, what have these allegations done to you? Do you sometimes wonder if things could have been, if you've kind of like crossed certain lines? How do you, when you look back now, when you look at your behavior on other people, what do you think? So do you see what I mean? I was like trying to get a personal sense of what the situation has done to him, but I couldn't speak legalistically about the alleged crimes. So that was a really, really difficult interview.
We can see the wire, walking on the wire the whole time you're reading the article.
Yes.
Line, it's broken down into 7 different chapters, I believe. And, you know, just walking the tightrope, you could see the allegation, trying to balance that ship as you're moving forward with the story. Very interesting.
Well, thank you so much for reading it so closely. And I just want to, it's interesting what you said. You said you could identify with him being an outcast and trying to get back into the in-group. Can you expand a bit on that?
Yeah, I think there's times in my life where I've made mistakes within my friend groups or my family groups, socially, you know, doing things or saying things that really hurt people. And, you know, we make mistakes in life. And I think that it hurts to be banished for years. You know, there were times where I was banished from my own family circles for, you know, 4 years, 6 years, friend groups for 3 years. You know, and so I understand, I can relate whenever somebody gets canceled. You know, I fully can feel how that, but it's also a good thing that humans go through this, because it allows us to learn and to grow. Because otherwise, how would you grow if you don't go through these banishments? I think the important thing is to never say, screw the family, screw the friends. You know, I think it's always important to really think about how we hurt people and the time we spend away in the banished environments. Then we just have to like really think about what we did to hurt people. And I think for me, that has given me an opportunity to grow. But the healing oftentimes doesn't fully recover in the circles that you're banished from. So there's that too.
Yeah, I can totally see what you're saying. And probably, I remember when I spoke to him, it was also very clear that he was, you know, like he was deeply hurt. He always, you know, like insisted he had done nothing wrong. And indeed, in that trial, in the big trial in London, he was acquitted on all counts.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. How?
So, but still, he might have, you know, like he was also telling me what it was like to be like a global superstar, how you don't really see people anymore. You objectify them. You don't really get a sense. Yeah. Perhaps you don't really get a sense where people's boundaries are. Maybe you use your power. Maybe you use other people for your needs. Maybe you misinterpret, you know, like signals, or you just don't want to see when people say no. I mean, there are a lot of, also in my personal interaction with him, I just saw how, you know, like that he was indeed a person, you know, like full of dark trauma himself, which is why he played these dark characters with such, you know, brilliance, because he had it, you know, he had deep issues within himself with his own, you know, like sexuality, being gay, hiding it for a very long time and so on. So I could sense all that. He told me about it. I could sense all that as a reporter, and I tried to write it in a fair way. And then I got a lot of, you know, like the piece was hotly discussed. I mean, there's been no other piece that's been so controversial as this one. You know, like there were people, reporters who, you know, like wrote to me saying that this was, you know, like a brilliant piece of journalism, and they liked the very fact that we ventured so far into the gray zone of a person that who is kind of like symbolizes our society, but who's not seen as a good one. And then there were others who were saying, how can you even, you know, like devote so many pages to such a person? Are you giving a perpetrator a platform? Why are you doing it? So it was like there was an extremely heated debate. And in the piece, because it was like an international scoop, it went around the world. It was quoted in the New York Times like 3 times. And it was intense. It was intense, like kind of like, I don't know, just being a reporter, I was somehow infected by the fallout of it. Yeah.
You know, I wanted to ask 2 questions, and they're very kind of different, but the same. Number one, how has that experience of writing and covering the Kevin Spacey changed the way you think about journalism? And 2, how has it affected you professionally? So one's like an interior sort of internal kind of process. Has it affect your writing? Has it affect your style and the way you think about the approach? What have you learned? And then the other one is professionally, what has it done to your life? How has it changed it?
Well, I would say that, you know, I've done very difficult stories before. I've done investigative reporting. I've even reported on like Weinstein-like allegations of sexual, you know, like if you want, about victims of sexual assault. And I've done very difficult stories before, but this certainly on a human level, on a professional level, was by far the most difficult. And I learned that you might have to pay a very high price if you write about anything that could be seen as being part of it, taking place in a culture war. You have to pay a very high price if you write about, you know, uncomfortable truth, like the fact that this was a person who was officially banished, but still he has a lot of fans. This was a profile of somebody who was accused, not of somebody who was a victim, right? So these were, you know, like things that created a lot of kind of heated discussion. And I also learned that in the age of social media, a picture or the wrong picture or the false framing of the picture or headline can make a huge difference on how these debates go. So there's a few kind of like, if you want, like crafty things I would think about more next time in terms of how do we present it? How might people see it on, view it on social media, especially power of the image? But at the same time, I also feel as a writer, as a journalist and as a writer, I feel that it just shows how important it is to go into that space beyond good and evil. I do feel it's very, very important to explore in your writing the non-linear, contradictory, difficult, complex things that that are part of human nature and that part of our society. Maybe a story like this will kind of emotionally trigger a lot of people because it also describes a deep emotional abyss somehow, right? Abuse and, you know, disgrace, being outcast and so on. And so I feel that even though it was a really, really, really tough time reporting it, writing it, and then publishing it, it was also the most important story I've done. And it has, you know, like many, many people have talked to me about it. We are talking about it now. And
that's a big story. It's huge.
It was a bit, but it's a big story in itself. And then it also symbolizes a lot, I guess.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes what?
I paid a high price for it. I took a high risk. I paid a high price for it. But maybe that's what you have to do as a writer. If you want to, you know, like if you really want to somehow dig deep or find something that really touches people in a good or perhaps in a, you know, like irritated way, then maybe you need to go that far. And so it has, you know, like it wouldn't stop me from doing something like that again, but maybe I would be a bit more wise in terms of how to deal with, you know, culture wars and social media debates and so on.
It's interesting that you said this is the most important story that you wrote, because you wrote and covered the Essex Laurie deaths of the Vietnamese, and you actually got nominated for a really big German prize that's the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize for writing. So yeah, I would even argue that piece is bigger in your career than this Kevin Spacey piece, but I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, maybe in terms of how did it change me personally, maybe I should say that it's not, you know, like it's difficult to weigh the Kevin Spacey story against a story about a tragedy where 39 Vietnamese migrants were found dead in a lorry in the UK.
And being nominated for this big prize. Those are
yes, and I was nominated. Matter, yeah,
subject matter and being recognition for the writing is two very big things. But at the same time, the clarification of how it changed you internally makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, sorry, that's what I was saying. I think the Kevin Spacey story was just so challenging, personally, and then also in terms of dealing with the debate afterwards. That was kind of very important for my journey as a writer. The story about the Vietnamese migrants who died in the lorry in Essex, of course, was a huge, again, another story of global significance. It went around the world when the lorry was found with these 39 bodies. It was horrific. But of course, it didn't entail a controversial debate like that. And it got a lot of praise, but it was also very difficult reportrayed. I worked on it with a colleague of mine, and we found a girl who, you know, like had to want to go travel from Vietnam to the UK together with her twin sister, and they paid a smuggler, and she started describing in detail the journey they took, you know, like which passports they got where and how they changed it and, you know, like the different places they went to, the treks they took through Greece and Turkey and the housing. And then at some point, the two twin sisters got separated and one of them moved on and ended up in a lorry where later 39 people would die crossing over from Brussels. From France to the UK. But she survived. She stayed behind because she had a problem with the passport. She stayed in Spain and survived, but she'd lost her twin sister. So I wrote a story about these two together with my colleague. I described the journey of these two twin sisters. And it was horrific. It was, you know, like, and she was so young. She was working in a nail salon in Spain, undocumented, didn't speak any Spanish, of course. And she was still, you know, like she was traumatized, of course, by the death of her twin sister. They'd done everything together. They'd gone to a Catholic school together. They really were these like Vietnamese schoolgirls, like, to just want to take this big adventure to go to the West. And they were stuck. They're struck by this horrific tragedy. And she was traumatized. She was telling me all about it, but she was still hoping to get to the UK. And I said, "You cannot do this, right? Like, look, your sister's just died. And naturally, how can you? These bloody smugglers, they don't care. They, you know, just want to take your money. They don't care about the human life they're transporting." But she somehow had the sense that she had to accomplish that mission and then go there. And it was very, you know, it was also very, it was also, I could feel a trauma. And then, you know, like spending time with her, it just really, it was so, you know, like it really tore me up inside. And sometimes when you hear these stories, you think about your own life, right? You think about your own life of privilege and safety and comfort. And she had to go through this. And
Yeah,
I was just there.
it's crazy. Like, I'll go down to Orange County. Like, last night, I went out to a restaurant, and there were about maybe 15 young Vietnamese kids that were standing outside the restaurant, just hanging out. And I asked one of them to take a picture of my group, and she was clearly from Vietnam and a student here in the US. And there's 15 of them standing around talking, speaking Vietnamese, but they look very hip and they look very, modern. And when you're telling me about these twins, I'm thinking about the privilege that these 15 kids have experienced, as you know, coming from rich families, being able to get visas to go to school here in the United States, living in California, not having to deal with working as a nail tech in Spain, trying to figure out how to cross and risk your life to go to Britain. It is the most crazy thing when you think about the kinds of dreams that we have that we put our lives on the line to accomplish.
Absolutely. And, you know, like I spoke to a pastor in the UK. There's a big community in London. He was the one who actually helped the British police identifying the bodies, sending them back to the families in Vietnam, right? And so he had some of the family relatives, family members in his congregation. And he said, "They come here, and some of them, they live, you know, they only work. It's like being a modern slave." That's what he said. Because sometimes people come here, they have these huge debts they have to pay back, thousands and thousands of dollars, right? So they just work 6 days a week. They live together in like shared housing. They don't really know the language, or they don't really know their way around. When I visited the girl, like, she'd already been in Spain for a few months, but she'd never been to the beach, although it was a beach place, so we
Wow.
went to beach together.
And how did you
And
find her?
my colleague, you know, I just told you about the pastor who'd gone to, he'd gone to Vietnam. He collected money in the UK, and then he flew to Vietnam to give the money to the families, right? And I had already been in touch. I'd met him in London. Took up contact with him in London, and my colleague went with him. So she met basically 39 families of the deceased. And a lot of them didn't want to talk about it to the media, because in Vietnam, people are very suspicious of the media. And of course, it's also talking, you know, it's also sometimes they're also afraid of smugglers who might be part of the community or people they know, so they don't want to speak out against it. And it was like an international crime case as well, right? And it was murder. It was, I don't know, well, manslaughter. Anyway, so it was difficult. My colleague spoke to them, and then one of them, she finally found a family that said, "Right, yeah, we have two twin girls. They both went on a journey. One of them died, one survived, and she's in Spain, and you can talk to her." And that's when I flew to Spain. Yeah, as I mentioned before, the journalistic pieces I do are very kind of big and complicated, expensive. Take a very long time to research and to write. Right. It took us half a year to report that story, and there were a lot of kind of news pieces about it, and a lot of also Western media went up to BBC, right? They went to Vietnam, they visited the family, and there would be quite kind of like shared talking about their grief, but there was no other story that detailed the whole route and, you know, like that personal tragedy in a way that we did. Perhaps also because we're both second generation Vietnamese. So I think we did have a different connection, right, to the families that we spoke to. And spoke Vietnamese with the girl. My Vietnamese is not that great, but we spoke a mixture of Vietnamese, and then I had like a translator who would help us with the piece. But I think there was a different sense of trust for these families, meeting people, journalists like us, who share that background. I think they were perhaps more willing to show the real, open up, to show the real side of the story, if you know what I mean. I felt that sometimes when I spoke to the Western media, that they only showed one part of the story. We're so sad that our children have died, and all this is true, but there's also a whole kind of like rabbit hole underneath it, right? The story of dreams, the story of opportunities, the story of big houses being built in provinces in central Vietnam with the money that people earn in nail salons in the West 6 days a week, and they send it home, and then their relatives can build a nice big house. And then it turns into a dream, and it turns into inspiration, and people think, oh, well, if they can do it, then we can do it too. And it will be okay. We'd be like traveling a bit. But then, of course, they're risking their life, and some of them die.
Yeah, because I don't think that they understand the dangers that are up ahead. It's a big black box that they don't realize that. I think Mexicans coming from Mexico coming up to the U.S. the same way. Many times they are unaware of the actual potential dangers of what's ahead. But I think in Europe, it's a lot more... you know, there's a lot more going on, moving parts. I think in Mexico to the U.S., it's sort of a straight shot. Yeah, there's a lot of danger. But I think, you know, in Europe, there's just a lot more moving parts that are happening.
I don't know. I wonder, you know, like, of course, like with these things like these, there are no official statistics. So I don't know if the number of undocumented migration has actually gone down after that horrific accident. Maybe not so much, because people will say, right, this was a terrible accident, like a bus accident, bus kind of like crushing down a bridge, but we still kind of, the whole system stays intact. I mean, some of the people get caught, but then the whole system gets intact. The dream is still alive. The money's still being wired over. And in Europe too, of course, we have a lot of people who die kind of trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. It's horrific.
Right.
But still people try to make it somehow.
You know, I want to
I don't know,
get
maybe you
this.
Just, when you take that risk, maybe you just don't think, sorry?
Yeah. You just don't think about it. You don't think about the what's going to happen. Just like I think in the 1975, when all these people left Vietnam, they just don't think about, you know, what's better than the current situation and circumstance they're living in is what's outside, not what's in here, you know. And I think that the prospect of a better future is worth losing your life.
I think you're right. I think people really keep their eyes on focused on the future.
Yeah.
They don't think so much about the journey or the risk that it takes, or they just say it's going to be the price that I will pay. More than anything else, they feel they need to escape their current circumstances.
Yeah, the present circumstance is so painful that they're just like, okay, this is not... you're living in hell, so you might as well get out of it and risk your life to get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems so. It seems so. I did speak to her. I was like, really? Do you really want to, after what happened to your sister, do you really want to try to go to the UK, come into a, one of those lorries? Why did, and I thought, why don't you try to, like make it in Vietnam? This country's changed so much. Maybe go to one of Hanoi or Saigon. Maybe you speak the language. Maybe you can get, you have good grades. Maybe you can get like good qualification and find a job there. It's not nest the West, living in the West is not necessarily better. Yeah, the country's richer doesn't mean it's better. It doesn't mean you're going to be happy here. But she was really fixated on it, and actually she did make it to the UK, and she was
But you know
in a nail salon.
that's a very interesting thing that you brought up right now is just because you're in the West does not mean you're guaranteed a better life. I'm going to make a little argument. I think when you come from absolutely, nothing, when you come from a very hard place in life, and you and I are born in the West, we don't have that hardship. No matter how hard we think our lives were compared to like other Germans or Americans that we grew up with, our lives cannot possibly be harder than the people who are putting their lives on the line, first generation to come to a new country. And I think no matter I deal with this a lot, this thought just for my personal living is that how could people live? How could people leave their country of origin and think the West is better? Well, actually, I think this is just my own weird logic, but I actually think that for people who are coming from places that are very difficult living, they're actually coming to the West and they're going to make big moves and they're going to work a lot harder than somebody like you and me relative to what they're going through. Relative to their circumstance, they're going to use the opportunity of the West to create a better life, and they typically do. When they get here, they work harder. I'm pretty sure that there a lot of people are working harder than I am. For fact. Like physically, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, they're doing that, and they're building homes, and they're. And I think that the second generation, I'm speaking just for myself. There's no way that I can work that hard. It's just because I was born in the West and I don't have that same mentality. So it's like the privilege that we have. And I just want to recognize the privilege that I have when I think about somebody like this woman going to from Spain to Britain. She's going to in light, there's an engine fire that's lit up inside of her that's going to really, the legacy of her sister that died, and all of these things are going to propel her to the next level that she's never had before in her life. And it's hard for us to comprehend, hard for me to comprehend the amount of work that a lot of my cousins did when they first got to the United States at 14, 15 years old.
I've seen it over and over again. Immigrants who sometimes have the reputation of being whatever, lazy criminal, or just take the money of the state in
Absolutely.
Germany. They work so much
So
harder
much
than
harder.
anyone else. They don't know the work-life balance, right? They don't take holidays.
No.
They don't take weekends. They don't take sick days. They just work. They do sometimes they do physical work. Everything they really sacrifice themselves. Very often they sacrifice themselves for their children, so their children would have a better life. So that's us, second generation. And I noticed within myself that I was always very aware of that. I was very aware of the work that my parents have done so we could have a better life. I don't think they actually, they never said it out clearly, but there was this sense in me that somehow I needed to make it worthwhile. Somehow I needed to make something out of my own life so theirs wouldn't be wasted. And I would also say about myself that I'm not as hardworking as my parents, but I'm pretty tough. And I do feel that this has a lot to do with the fact that I come from this immigrant family, that I come, that was raised with this consciousness that you know, nothing is going to be handed out to you. Nobody has waited for you to come along. You really need to work your way into the society. You need to prove yourself. You need to be better to be accepted as equal. And maybe even if you are better, you will still not be accepted as equal. And so I think that, you know, like, maybe it makes you a bit harsh inside. I sometimes wonder, whether we are a bit harsh. Also, this Vietnamese second generation, sometimes see people, they have that within them. They need the need to show themselves, to prove themselves, to work hard, to never take a rest. I see that a lot in other people, and I probably have it too. But it also, in a way, it also got me to where I am. Because otherwise I wouldn't, if I didn't have that drive, I didn't have that work ethic, the sense of needing to prove myself, then I wouldn't have been able to push through with some of the things that I've done.
I completely agree with that. And that brings us to the next topic, which is the first generation and second generation that I experience here in the United States is almost similar to what you are going through in Germany with, I don't know, maybe I'm making an assumption, but the far right is a big movement in Germany now. And I think I can imagine how Vietnamese immigrants of the first generation probably has leanings towards anti-immigration, leanings towards being against new immigrants. How is this all playing out in Germany?
Well, we have, so of course, first of all, Germany has a horrific past, being the country where fascism rose to the top. They elected Hitler. They fought two world wars, started two world wars, and fought the second one in the name of racial supremacy. They killed 6 million people. So they do have a deep, dark history with nationalism. And now, recently, we have seen the rise of a far-right party. It's difficult because you have a different electoral system. There are some parallels with some aspects of the MAGA movement, links to white supremacists, conspiracy theories, certain affinity towards Putin's Russia, masculinity. But here it's also mixed with that kind of like a certain yearning for the past, to German supremacy, whatever. And they're doing very well in Eastern Germany, which is the former socialist part of Germany, and which is economically weaker than the West. And so I don't know how Vietnamese people here are looking at AFD, at that party. I heard of a Vietnamese German politician who sits in parliament for them, in a regional parliament for them. And she was accused of, you know, like people saying, how can you work for a racist party when you're in second generation immigrant yourself? And she was basically saying, well, even if I'm second generation immigrant, I could still, you know, like look at it, immigration, and say that, you know, criminals should not be part of this country. If you're well assimilated, integrated, then you're welcome to stay, but otherwise no. And AFD is not racist. So it's, but it's not, I don't think it's, the phenomenon is not as big as it is with Asian American voters in support of Trump. But there seem to be some sympathies, but it's from, at least from what I gather, it's rather small.
Oh, so that's good.
Well, what's your experience in the U.S.?
For the Vietnamese community, I think it's predominantly first generation in support of MAGA, in support of Trump.
Right.
I was in Orange County last weekend, and there was like a parade of Trump flags and maybe 40 cars going down the main strip of Bolsa, and they were waving and honking in big cars with Jeeps and you know, it's really loud honking and in support of the MAGA movement and obviously for Trump. So it's a big thing. And having that sort of like, it's almost generational separation, but I've actually run into a lot of second generation who are very pro MAGA, pro Trump people.
Really? Second generation too? And why? What were their reasons for supporting it?
I think it's more economics for them. They are under the impression, whether it's true or not, under the impression that the economy was better under the Trump administration. And so that has bled into this sort of I am part of the American dream. I have done everything model minority as a Vietnamese second generation, and I deserve to be an American. And anybody who's coming in illegally should not be coming here. And so there's a very distinct line in the sand about progressives rooting for maybe reform in immigration and doing it correctly versus just flat out saying, no, we shouldn't have any new people here and there should be no immigration because we've already made it. We don't need more people to take our jobs. And
yeah, it's this drawbridge mentality. And indeed, sometimes immigrants are much more blunt when talking about immigration, right? Or talking about different groups. They're so much more blunt and not politically correct. But I just kind of like looking at it from that German perspective, where, as I said, we had fascism at its height. Deep down, you have these neo-Nazi elements. And for them, at the end of the day, it's really about skin color. And it's really about having the right type of blood, right? They're these kind of wishy-washy conservatives who would say, oh yeah, we can, if you're well integrated or whatever, good immigrants, bad immigrants. But the thinking behind, deep down, is a nationalist one. And it's one that's based on races and skin colors and superiority, thinking that some are superior and others are not. Putting people into different categories of worthiness. So I'm very suspicious of that. And also don't really like the good immigrant versus bad immigrant mentality, even though, because I know it so well, right? Didn't we all grow up with that sense that we need to be the good immigrants because out there the bad immigrants, the Germans don't like the bad immigrants. We really need to do our best to be the good immigrants. So pits one against the other.
I think that's everywhere. I think that's in Germany. I think it's in England. I think it's in America. It's this idea of you know, and I'm sure it's in Vietnam with the Jalung and, you know,
of just
with Chinese people, you know, growing up in Vietnam. Same thing. I think it's just part of our programming as human beings to separate that we are, you know, even though we just got here, we are the better immigrants. We're the model minority. I think it's just a normal thing to really think about.
But ingrains in you to kind of like perform yourself in a certain way, you know, you have to, you always want to do everything right. You always want to please other people. You don't want to kind of cause any problems. That would you grow up with a sense of, oh, I must not cause any problems. I have to be perfect. I have to always deliver. I have to have good grades. I have to get a good job, you know, like, so people will pat me on my shoulder and say, great. But I'm a writer, and I'm interested in thoughts and people and exploring relationships. And I feel that this is a lot about, you know, like showing who, kind of going to depth of your own self and freeing yourself from expectations, showing where people will burden you with expectation. And very often, let's be honest, there are very simple cliches that people will put upon you. Simple cliches of what it means to be an Asian woman, right? And then kind of like, you need to spend so much energy kind of dealing with these cliches and not to kind of disappoint people. But then really, why? Why? And what have they done to prove themselves to me?
Otherwise, yes.
Why didn't you try to impress me?
Quay, I want to get into Brothers and Ghosts. How did it come about? And I think you wrote it in a year. I mean, which is like, that's a breakneck speed to me. That's like very fast to get something going, right? It took you a year to write it? I mean, that's what I've read.
No, it's completely the opposite. It took me 4 years.
Okay, that's what I thought. I was like, okay, yeah, because I've never heard of anybody writing something that takes a year. I think an article can take a year almost, you know, let alone a book.
Yeah.
No. Okay. How did that book, Brothers and Ghosts, come about?
So due to my work as a magazine writer, I was kind of like approached by a literary agent, and he asked me if I wanted to, you know, write a book. I'd co-written a nonfiction book before, a few years before. And then I thought it would be nice to, yeah, try something, write a new book on my own. And I initially really struggled to find the right topic. I tried different things. And then I almost felt that, you know, the story of my family would be really interesting, but I shied away from taking it on initially because I thought, oh, I don't want to be that cliche. I don't want to be that Vietnamese German writer who writes about Vietnamese identity. So predictable, so boring, right? So I tried all these other things, these other two or three different stories, potential book stories, and it just didn't work. They didn't have any, not enough strength and tension and contradictions within them. So I turned to the story of my family. And so my family is divided, scattered all over the world, like so many of our families, yeah. Right? So I was born in Germany. My mother's family lives in Saigon. And then my father's family largely lives in California. So three continents. And I was always, first of all, very simply, I was interested in how did that actually come about? How did we end up being spread all over the world? And I also knew just from our family visits every few years that somehow I had this really interesting, confusing, funny characters in my family. And they had sometimes mentioned little stories on the sidelines about Thai pirates. And then I have an aunt who is, you know, like she speaks sign language. She's hearing impaired. And, you know, like I had all these interesting characters I didn't really know. But I didn't really know their biographies or how they ended up being the way they were. So I decided to approach it like a journalist. And I went up to my relatives and interviewed them. I conducted long personal interviews, maybe a bit like you do in your family project. Long historical biographical interviews where I asked my aunts and uncles on a one-on-one basis, you know, like how they grown up, what their school was like, what was family like, how did things change after 1975, how did they ever make it to the US, what was, oh, you were in prison, how, what was that like, oh, and you were only 14, never knew that, right? So they told me all these stories, which were stories of war and escape and hopes, sometimes unfulfilled hopes, very often unfulfilled hopes, drama. And I had, you know, like a bunch of notebooks. And then I thought, well, right, this is my book. And it took me a long time to write it down, but I eventually did.
And then you compiled the story over 4 years. And, you know, when you talk about like cliche, right? I get it. I understand. Because we're always thinking like, this is the same pattern we're hearing all over the world. You know, how do you break free from that?
Well, you know, the thing is, in Germany, again, that's different to US. We don't have stories like that. We don't have many stories like that. We did not have a piece of literature describing this experience at all was the first one. So it wasn't, even though I was scared of fulfilling cliche, it was also something that hadn't really been done before. And I decided, like as I started going deeper into the writing process, I decided to not just simply describe the stories of my uncles and aunts and so on, but I decided to turn it to a piece of fiction and create a different family where I would sometimes, take some episodes one uncle told me and mix them with an episode of another uncle. And, I just used their memories and anecdotes as little building blocks for a new story. And then it finally became like a multi-generational family drama told through three different characters. The main character is 30 and she's born in Berlin, and then she doesn't even accept her Vietnamese name, Kiều. She calls herself Kim. And then the story of her father, who came to Germany, from Vietnam to Germany, and became involved in the 68 anti-war movement. And her uncle, who stayed behind in Vietnam, was there during the fall of Saigon. He later goes to California and becomes a supporter of Donald Trump. So I described the story of a family through to these three characters and their experiences. And, I think when I, because I had all these real stories at hand, I had so much real material, so many details, up until, like the color of the school uniforms and the type of cigarettes people would smoke, the type of cigarettes people would use to pay smugglers and so on. So I think that really helps to break cliches, to not, because cliches are always lazy thinking, right? And they're just kind of like big boxes. And then when you go really deep into the human experience, really to go really deep into history, then you realize it's everything is gray and everything is a bit more complicated than the cliche suggests. And so, yeah, that's how I did it.
And really, what you just said about acknowledging the gray areas is really the difference between being in the know and not being in the know, being not educated, but sort of aware. Is I find, and this is going to be very controversial to say, but I find that the first generation, for the most part, many times has trouble with talking about the gray zones, gray areas. It's always binary, black, white, very little is paid attention to the nuances of both sides of a conversation of, politically and these topics. The more we can get into the gray zone, the more we can understand the details and understand everybody's perspective, there'll be less fighting.
Sure, and I think maybe in the first generation, especially in California, you have a lot of people are politically aligned with a certain side, right? With the former South Vietnam. So they are partial. They kind of like they're biased.
Very biased.
Whereas I'm not, I'm second generation, I'm more removed from it. And I have these two characters, the father and the uncle, both representing one side. But the book doesn't say that either of them is right or wrong.
Right.
I just want to pit them against each other. I didn't want to take a side about the Vietnam War, but I was more interested in describing the ambivalence that it has created, the polarization it has created within families, between brothers and sisters, like people. And it happened a lot with a lot of Vietnamese families. Some people were for the north, some people were for the south. And how do you deal with that? And it's a phenomenon that goes beyond the Vietnamese diaspora. You can see it everywhere. You can see it with, you saw it in the pandemic with how to deal with the vaccines, yes or no, right? Here in Germany, Russia is a big topic. So you always have the potential political issues can really divide human bonds, if you want. They can put people suddenly on two different sides of the spectrum. How do you deal with that? I was more interested in that aspect rather than taking a side and saying this is right or this is wrong.
I have two questions. First question is very basic. Where can we in America pick up the book? That's the first question. And the second question is tricky to answer, and hopefully you can navigate how to answer this. I believe Ocean Vuong, his quote is on the cover of your book, correct? How did that happen?
Well, I met Ocean a few years ago. He was in Berlin to present his first novel on Earth for Briefly Gorgeous, been translated to German. And I saw it and I was like, oh, I want to interview him. And I did. So I interviewed him, and he was such a kind, but also inspiring person. And, we met in a hotel room. I interviewed him, and I was like, I'm second generation Vietnamese too, and I'm actually starting to write my first novel. And he said, oh, that's great, you should do it. I was like, oh, I'm a bit anxious because there hasn't ever been anything like that before. I don't know if readers will take to it. And he was really encouraging. He told me that, it's like running in the sand. It's running in the snow. There's this landscape of snow which is untouched until you go and leave your footsteps in it. Just go into the snow. So I don't know. And then later on, when I first had the draft, I kind of emailed him very shyly. And I said, I remember our conversation. I feel very embarrassed to ask, but would you perhaps mind taking a look?
Wow.
Yeah, just sharing some thoughts on it. I was so I was so nervous to ask him.
That's why I'm so blown away, because I don't recall ever seeing. I mean, I'm sure he's written blurbs for other people, but I just haven't seen that ever. And just to see his name and what
on a German book
on the cover.
Yeah, it came because we, in that time it was a German room, so we translated for him. We translated 30 pages for him, and I wrote a summary of the whole book so we can get a sense of where the story would go. And he's like, yeah, I will take a look and I will see if I have anything to say. And I was like, oh my God, this is going to be really embarrassing. Maybe he's just going to say it's shit. But then he was so, he was so, so kind, gave me this quote. And, later on when we had the English version, I sent it to him. And now he's super famous, of course. I mean, everybody knows him. And it's great to have his endorsement. But it's, of course, Ocean, as others as well, as other Vietnamese American writers, his work is important to me. I do feel a relationship to it, not just because of one encounter or not because of one blur, but I somehow do feel indebted to it.
Vietnam. Absolutely.
All right? It's Monique Chung. It's there are so many more. And because I don't really have that in Germany yet, we're getting there. The Vietnamese second generation, they're more kind of a friend of mine just published a nonfiction book. And so there are more and more people coming and kind of writing. But we just don't have the numbers. We just don't have that tradition yet. So it is very important for people like me to have, that American influence, if you want to.
Yeah.
And our shows like yours, they do, they do really, I do feel they reach out to the world. They reach people, Vietnamese diaspora in other countries. And it helps us feel somehow connected to that community. I do feel somehow a little bit connected to the community of Vietnamese diaspora writers. And it's been very cool to, now that we have the book, and now that the English version of the book has come out, that I've been connecting to some of them, and it's really, really nice. And oh yeah, you can get it. You should be able to order it at your American bookstore. Of course, you can get it on Amazon.
Amazon, great.
Yeah, yeah. So
wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, Quay, thank you so much for a wonderful session. You know, always a treat for me to get to hear Vietnamese from overseas, from different diaspora or, communities, share their thoughts and share their journeys with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been also really, really interesting to speak to you. I feel we could, next time we have to meet for a drink, next time I come to the US, and I would just like, you'll tell me a bit more about the things that made you an outcast. I am so interested in hearing more.
You can ask me. We have a few more minutes. Feel free to ask, you know, I know you
had... Yes. What was it that you did kind of wrong, or did you even do something wrong? Or where did it come from, I guess?
There's two experiences that I had. One was a very close uncle, one of my mother's younger brothers, said a few words to me and I just lost it on him. I completely disrespected him in front of my mom and dad. And he was one of the favorite uncles of all of our cousins. And because I fought him so bad that one time, for the next 4 or 5 years, I, you know, every time he was going to go to an event, my entire family would be like, oh, uncle will be at that event. You should think twice about coming to that dinner. So it put this space between me and my whole entire family. And that relationship affected me and other cousins that were part of that that world. And it was very difficult. He and I are great today. We're very close today. We're back on track.
But what was the, can I just ask, what was it that he initially said? And that what,
it's how did so silly. It is so silly. He is a big Japanese car lover at the time. He loved Lexus. And I had just bought a brand new Mercedes. It was So I pulled up the Mercedes because my mom and dad were at his house. So I wanted to show the car to my mom and dad. And so I pulled up to his car. He opens up the door and I said, hey, I just got a brand new Mercedes. And the first thing he said is, fuck Mercedes. Lexus number one. That's what he said. And I lost my mind. Silly, right? But it's still not really that. Is those kinds of things are not the things that really break you, right? Or breaks the relationship. It's the things that were mounting up before that that really is the thing that charges something and breaks it, right? Because it's all of the things that happened with me and him in business. You know, we were business partners for a few years. Mm-hmm. And I felt sort of maybe an inequity. And so like all of that ammunition, that energy for me to unload on him at that moment in front of my mom and dad was sort of in my mind like the flame that lit the TNT explosive. You know, it lit off this really violent expression, and I got into his face, and my mom and dad had to hold me back.
It's interesting that one of the first things you said about that incident was that you kind of like offended him in front of other people. I think that's very Asian. I mean, that makes it even much, much worse. And he's your uncle.
Yeah, much worse.
Right? That makes it just much, much more worse.
Yeah, and you know,
but that's...
Yeah.
You defied the rules of hierarchy, familiar hierarchy, but maybe you did it and you know you did so. Because there probably had been a reason, right? You alluded there had been some
history there. And you know, maybe I misread it, but I don't know if I really understood it to be really Mercedes is inferior to Lexus. I didn't read it that way. Mm-hmm. I read it like you are threatening my position in the hierarchy because he was the best businessman, still is the best businessman in our family. And so I think that pulling up to his house in a brand new Mercedes was a little threatening to him at the time.
I think family hierarchies, I mean, I do actually see that there can be some sense to it and in creating order or whatever. I do see the Confucian sense in it. But sometimes they're just, I don't know, sometimes they are just so stifling. And they're simply based on age and birth order. And and yet we are all human beings with our ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, that's maybe also another generational conflict, right?
Yeah.
We kind of, when you grow up with the West, you are... you grow up with this individualism, with this idea that you define yourself through who you are, what you do, what you say. And right, and we've talked about it before, and we're so trained to prove ourselves and work hard. So why should it suddenly not make a difference when it comes to my family hierarchy, right?
It's
weird.
But it's also a rite of passage too, I think, as an American, Vietnamese American, for me, it was a sort of rite of passage saying, I'm going to break the chains of your hierarchy right here in front of you. And I didn't realize that what I was doing at the time. Looking back, obviously the learning is, the lesson is, you know, you don't need to, I didn't need to be that inhumane. You know, I needed to probably perhaps sit down with him at a later date and said, hey, uncle, like that statement really hurt me. You know, we could debate other ways that Lexus is better than Mercedes. You know, we could find a way to say that, but I'm not sure that that was the right way to do it at your doorstep in front of my mom and dad, you know? So that's the sort of lesson that so whenever I think about any conflict that it immediately rises to my mind, I'm able to tap back into that moment in history. The other thing that happened was a series of like missteps of me speaking or ignoring women in my group of friends. And what I didn't understand was this misogyny of like, whenever I showed up to like a big group, I would only talk to the husbands, right? Because Confucianism states that men and women have to be divided. You do not want to have the optics of flirting with other men's wives. So that became ingrained inside of me as a, you know, very early on. So I wouldn't say hi to the women. I would feel a little awkward, to be honest with you. And I didn't know how that was being shown into the real world. That was shown as like, I only think that the men were important. The younger guys in the group who are not married would go to the girls first, would go to the women first. They would give big hugs and sit with the women at the dinners. And they would hang out with the women, have a few drinks with the women, and then come speak to the men. And then I didn't realize that this was all happening. So I think a few years of this happening, I was labeled a misogynist. And from the things that I said to all of the statements and the words, and I began to analyze that, oh my God, I have this misogynistic tendency to ignore women and not to pay attention. And some people in the beginning of the podcast, early years, were like, hey, look at the number of men that you have on versus how many women. You have no women on in the early days. And so I began to really do a deep dive in the last few years about that. So, you know, being banished from the kingdom, I mean, I'm just giving you the general sides of it, not going into the details for obvious reasons. But, you know, it's really helped me kind of see that that the things that we think are right, because the way we're think we're protecting our relationship between me and married women, is not the case. That's definitely not the case. It's everybody should be equal. You come in, say hi to everybody and hang out with everybody and not create these lines in the sand, invisible sand.
So I guess in both cases, it's a bit unlearning some of the things that we grew up with.
And imagine how much other stuff that, and this is probably just the tip of the iceberg, because there's probably all this other, you know, built-in tracks that's in my mind coming from being raised as a Vietnamese man. It's very toxic. It can be very toxic masculine energy. And I think that me spending a lot of time with a lot of Vietnamese men that are older than I am these days, it's great that we go on these men trips, all male, and we can act all funny about all this stuff. But I try to really talk to these men about like these different sides of how the women are seeing, how we're being portrayed in their eyes, and we have to do better.
Well, you know, it's great to hear. I think it's great to hear that you're taking that feedback.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me. And hopefully one day we can get more into it. And hopefully I can write about, you know, the toxic male unlearning that, you know, and I've put it into 100,000 words already, you know, and I just need to find my... I'll be reaching out to you for notes.
Yes, please do.
I would definitely reach out to you now that I know.
Hopefully
you don't get shitty writing either. Quay, thank you so much. I really appreciate your openness and sharing with us today.
Cool. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope we can continue in person next time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.